By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising.
Welcome back to The String. I'm Craig Havokhurst, and this hour we're talking about Glen Campbell with two people who know him very well. His daughter Ashley, now 29 years old and launching her own solo career after years on the road in her father's band, and Carl Jackson, who was a member of Campbell's band for 12 years in the 70s and 80s. After this last segment with them, I speak with director James Keach about his award-winning documentary, I'll Be Me, which tracked Campbell's final tour and battle with Alzheimer's disease. And then some rare tape of Glen being interviewed in 1969. Now let's pick up with Ashley Campbell, who at this point was about to go into the studio with her brother as producer to make her debut album.
Did you write all the material on this record, or do you like to borrow songs and collect them and mix and match them?
I did write all the material. I have all the songs picked out pretty much, but I'm still writing. You know, if I write something that I love, of course I'll put it on the album.
Yep.
But yeah, I wrote all the material, and there's one song there that I'm thinking about recording that I didn't write, but my brother Shannon wrote it.
Yeah.
So I'm keeping it in the family.
Yeah.
Yeah, for the most part, I do believe in writing my own stuff. But like I said, my dad wasn't a big songwriter, and he, you know, he would, if he found a good song, he would record it. So I'm open to it in the future. But I think for me, it's important to have my first album be my voice.
Right. Will this be an acoustic? Would you call it an acoustic project, or are you letting any texture come in that feels like the song calls for?
It's gonna be whatever it turns out to be. What I'm excited about is all I know is acoustic. I know I write the songs, I play them on guitar or banjo, and that's my world. You know, that's
right.
My wheelhouse. And my brother Cal is the complete opposite direction.
Oh.
And so he's this amazing producer. I think he is so talented, and he's a drummer too. So I want to have this album where old world meets what's happening now, you know, and Cal is like a whiz at what's happening now. So I really want to create something that, you know, people haven't heard much of before. So I'm excited to see what our collaboration will bring.
Man, well, you said I am too. That's cool. When you've been out on tour pretty regularly, you play festivals and fairs, and what is your band set up and your repertoire right as it has been?
My band set up right now is, you know, when I have my full band out there, it's me. I play banjo and guitar, mm-hmm. and then I've got my friend Will on dobro, and I like to have fiddle, drums, bass, and then my brother Shannon comes with me and he sings harmony and plays acoustic guitar.
Right.
Yeah.
I just to swing back to the documentary for a second, it was interesting watching you watch Glen and be very attuned. Everybody in the band had to be attuned to whether a vamp is going to go on, you know, as long as it takes, mm-hmm. or you may have to hitch and take a little left turn, but everybody did it with absolute attention and professionalism, and I'm wondering if that was a really part of the learning experience for you as a musician in a group.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, you learn to really not be so focused on what you're doing. You need to know what you're doing, and then you can focus on other people and be listening to what other people are doing and where the song's going. You know, because if you focused on yourself, if you're afraid, if you don't know what you're doing, you're gonna miss out on what's happening on stage. So you know, it's kind of a professionalism thing, I guess, but we had to be ready for anything with my dad being like he was. My dad's musical director and piano player TJ Kinster had a talkback mic, so we all had in-ears in, and he could talk to us on stage during the show. So he'd be like, "Oh, we're doing the solo on Wichita again. We're doing it again. Go back to the solo." Yeah. Oh, so we'd all, you know.
Wow.
Or, yeah, you know. So you just had to be just eyes open.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cool. Now, you guys made a wonderful record together that we're going to feature tonight on the Orthophonic Joy Project, which Carl produced. You do a traditional tune that is a train crash song I had never heard before.
Yeah.
I love the record, Carl, the old 97, but this is the record, The Virginian, mm-hmm. based on a true story. How'd you find that song and match it up with her voice, and why'd you choose it?
I will say this before you go into whatever you're going to say. Like, if you hear the original of this song, you would go, how did you create a song out of that? There's no chords.
Thank you.
There's nothing. It's just, you know, it's this sweet old blind guy.
Yeah.
Like, blind Al Reed, says
blind
his name.
Blind Alfred Reed.
Alfred Reed. And he's just playing this creaky old fiddle and singing, "Come on, ye bareboat railroad man, and listen while I tell."
That's pretty much exactly how it goes, yeah.
And Carl just arranged this beautiful number with actual chords and stuff. There's stuff in the song.
There's stuff in the song.
And he, you know, he coached me when I was recording vocals. Like, he just, he's such a great leader. So you go on about talk about this.
I appreciate that very much. I love the lyric on the song. And it was, of course, on the original Bristol Sessions. The Orthophonic Joy record, it was important to re-record some of those songs. And I went through every one of the 76 songs and picked my favorite things. And when I was throwing things at Ashley, she liked the lyric on that song, too.
I like train songs.
And she liked train songs. And she liked the ideas I had on it, because I'd come up with kind of that little banjo part that you play. And I think I'd put it down on my iPhone and kind of showed it to her.
Because you don't really play much clawhammer.
No, I don't.
You wanted it in clawhammer.
But I kind of wanted it in clawhammer style. So I just kind of faked it and showed her what I wanted.
Yeah.
And then let her take it from there. And she just mastered it.
Good man we all loved well. Over 20 years he ran the rails known as Virginia Line. A faithful engineer who always pulled his train on time.
I learned actually to play clawhammer or clawgrass through listening to Steve Martin's albums, because I was obsessed with him when I started learning banjo.
Oh, okay.
So I'd listen to him and I would try and figure out what he was doing. And then I actually met Mark Johnson, who taught Steve Martin how to play that style.
That's right.
And so Mark showed me how to actually do it. I was definitely doing a couple things wrong, but he made it a lot easier.
So for folks who haven't heard this, the bluegrass traditional style is founded by Earl Scruggs. Three rolling fingers, and then clawhammer is that downstroking, plunky, really old, more mountain style.
Yeah, frailing.
Frailing is also called, and this is a hybrid of the two.
This is a hybrid of frailing and three finger style,
It is, and it really fit the song, you know, and like I say, I love the lyric on the tune, you know, and it's an absolutely true story. That crash happened in Englewood, West Virginia, in May of 1927, and so I thought that was really important too, to have that on there.
Wow, it was fresh news when it was fresh news. Bristol Sessions. That was like as current as the newspaper.
It was fresh news, absolutely. So I thought that was a really, really neat thing to have on the record.
Current event song.
Yeah. Ashley, have you been on, you know, a folk music journey? Have you made, woven into your life the chance to really burrow back the influences of the influences kind of journey?
Not as much as I would like to. I do listen to a lot of Doc Watson. I love Doc. I like his style of guitar playing and all that. But I'm just,
She's a sponge.
She's
a sponge. She picks up everything, and she picks it up quick.
Well, just to wrap up here, looking forward, we Glenn Campbell's in the Country Music Hall of Fame. He'll probably be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame one day.
It should be.
Hopefully. Are all thinking about his legacy, and the film was widely seen and appreciated as a memento of a precious time in an important life. And where do you hope to carry that? You know, the blessing, the burden, the legacy, the story going forward. How does one consciously play that part?
Well, with the documentary, I definitely hope that I'm still working with foundations and organizations to fund research for finding a cure for Alzheimer's. So I hope that I can continue that until the battle is won. And musically, I just love to carry on my dad's spirit of making music, where you make music that you love and that you're in love with and that makes you feel good, and hopefully if you like it, someone else is bound to like it too, you know, just music that touches soul, and hopefully you can touch other people's souls, you know.
That's absolutely true. That sounds like something I said, did you? I believe that with all my heart. You do things you love, You're not the only one that's going to love it, because when it's coming from your heart, it's going to touch others too. You're not going to get it 100% of everybody, so you can just forget that.
Music is a hard job if you're really going for it and trying to get yourself out there. It's a difficult life. It's not easy. Yeah. And so if you don't love what you're doing, there's no point. Go find something else to do.
Do you actually feel unambiguously driven toward that life? Is that something that for you, you know, is it? Or do you go, I don't have to be that. There's other things to do in life. Where are you on that scale?
I'm not a big ultimatum kind of person. So, I mean, if for some reason I couldn't make music or I couldn't make music professionally, like if I had to get a job, I'd be like, well, I can still play music and you still do music. It doesn't have to be a job. It's just, it's what you do. So that I don't ever have to stop doing that. You never know where life's going to lead you, but I hope that I get to play music for the rest of my life, and I hope I get to make a living at it.
Us too. Ashley Campbell, Carl Jackson, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Craig.
It's knowing that your door is always open and your path is free to walk. That makes me tend to leave my sleeping bag rolled up and stashed behind your couch.
When Glenn Campbell went out on the final tour of his life, this is the song that typically opened the show, Gentle on My Mind, a John Hartford song that changed Glenn Campbell's fate as an artist in 1967. You heard my guests talk about it in the last segment, and now the filmmaker who heard that opening Gentle on My Mind quite a few times as he produced I'll Be Me, the poignant and heartening documentary about Glenn's life with Alzheimer's. Keech is a Hollywood veteran who's acted, directed, and produced, including the Johnny Cash biopic Walk the Line. I reached him by phone in California and asked him what launched the film's production and whether he was confident that a film would come out of the experience.
A man named Julian Raymond, who was producing Glenn's album, was also working with my son Johnny, who was 13 and just turned 14 at the time. Julian was with Warner Brothers, and Johnny's a musician who's in Nashville right now. You might hear of someday. He's just signed with Big Machine. And he would come over to my place, and I produced a movie a few years before called Walk the Line and directed a lot of other stuff. And Julian kept saying, you should consider doing a movie about Glenn Campbell. And I said, I don't really want to make another biopic. And I was working at the time. My partner at the time was Trevor Albert, who we'd worked on several movies together. But they're kind of comedies or, different types of pieces other than, a biopic. And he said, no, this wouldn't be a biopic. This would just be, covering, the first few weeks of Glenn's tour. He's only booked for 5 weeks. And oh, by the way, he's got Alzheimer's. And Trevor and I both felt like this was something that would probably not be that entertaining and would probably be really hard to do because he's got Alzheimer's. And Julian was very persistent. He says, come on, James, just meet him. And ultimately, I met with Glenn. He came over to the house, and my son Johnny, who I told you about, was walking across the living room with his guitar, and Glenn was there with Kim, and Glenn said, hey, I play guitar. You want me to show you something? And Johnny, of course, knew that was Glenn Campbell. He said, sure, show me something. And Glenn picked up the guitar and absolutely shredded it. He said, that's what my Uncle Boo taught me. It was like scales, all the different ways that Glenn knew how to, play his leads and all the different things that he played over the years. This was the foundation for it. He was showing it to John. And John, to this day, plays it. But at any rate, John said, well, thank you. And he went into his bedroom like all teenagers do. And Glenn turned to Kim and said, when a man findeth a good woman, he findeth a good thing. I found me a good thing, pointing to Kim. And you could just see how much he loved her. And then he said, Kim said, Glenn, we're here to talk to James about your Alzheimer's. He says, Alzheimer's? What's that? I don't got no Alzheimer's. I got part-timers. So, and then about then, Johnny comes walking back out of the bedroom, and he's got the guitar in his hand, and Glenn goes, hey, I play guitar. You want me to show you something?
Wow.
So you got the whole dynamic right there, and you got to see this guy. You got to see the Alzheimer's. You got to see he's got a sense of humor. He was self-deprecating. He was a genius musician and one of the sweetest human beings I'd ever met, and he totally was in love with his wife, who was a jewel. And so we decided, you know, what the heck, you know, we have all the camera equipment and, you know, 5 weeks, okay, this is what we're going to do. He's only booked for 5 weeks, so it turned into 2.5 years, 1,500 hours of film. And did I ever know that it would be an end? There would be an end? Yeah, of course it was going to be an end, because the tour would have to end at some point. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but I didn't know anything about Alzheimer's before. That's the reluctance was, this is, you know, something that that's a word that people are even scared to even say, because for fear that they might catch it. I know that sounds a little silly, but there's some truth to, you know, just let's not talk about the elephant in the room. And my approach to filmmaking is to not only talk about the elephant in the room, but to bring the elephant in the room and show the elephant and take care of the elephant. And so the accessibility with Glenn and his family became absolutely, totally personal. And we became very close. And Ashley's like my own daughter. And Kim is, we're really, really close. And I became very, very close to Glenn. And Glenn took this journey with him, and it was incredible. And, you got to see what it turned into. So,
had anything prepared you for making a movie with such an inevitable unhappy ending, or at least a major level, it's an unhappy ending, about a real person, a documentary that was going to come out so sad, and you were filming a decline, not something that had the chance of redemption or victory, and that's usually where a documentary kind of goes.
I didn't feel like it was the decline. I felt like it was redemption.
Great.
Glenn knew what he had. Glenn knew he had Alzheimer's. He knew what he was up against, and he wanted to share it with the world, and he wanted to do something about helping other people. So Glenn knew if you could take the shame out of the game, he was going to do something, even at this point in his life, that was going to be meaningful to people. And he wasn't afraid of the truth. And so I didn't ever view the movie as being sad. I was sad when it was over because I miss Glenn, and I miss being on the road with him. But, you know, this acceptance of what happens in life and the love the audience had for him, and the uplifting quality of so many of the members of the audience, they behaved the way people are supposed to behave. They didn't shun him. They didn't push him away. They uplifted him when he couldn't remember the lyrics to the songs. They cheered him on. They'd sing them to him. And there was this conversation, this beautiful conversation going on with Glenn and the audience, and seeing, you know, the courage of the family. I mean, it was, to me, it was not sad.
Fantastic.
It was very, very powerful and uplifting. You know, Alzheimer's, of course, is incredibly sad. But what's even more sad is people who have Alzheimer's, or families that are affected by it, who can't talk about it, who feel that they should be ashamed of what they have.
Right.
And that they should be secretive about what they have. What Glenn did was he brought this to the forefront, and over 7 million people saw it. And we would get letters from people saying that how they'd been seen, and how my mom was this way, and my dad, or my brother, whatever. And so now this conversation had started. He had done just as much service by doing this as he did by singing, you know, Rhinestone Cowboy.
Nice.
Maybe more.
Right.
Maybe more.
Right. It opened the world up for me. It made the abstract very, very human. What did you explore or learn, or what struck you about the gulf between his ability to operate in day-to-day life and his musicianship? Obviously, music and neuroscience is a big topic, roaring along with a lot of research, and there's a lot of wonderful, amazing discoveries. Was that something you were prepared to, were you surprised by it, and did you try to mine it as a subject and learn more about it that we didn't see in the film?
Well, I'm actually doing a film about finding the drug to cure Alzheimer's now, so I'm dealing with the neuroscientists on a totally different level.
Great.
But what it did was, the fascination, obviously, at the beginning was, how can a man with Alzheimer's who can't remember how to get off the stage play the songs the way he could? And, you know, he might, the words, he might have forgotten words at times, but he did not forget how to play the notes. And he never, never went out of key. I'm talking about his singing.
Right.
Sometimes he'd start the song out of key. But he would sing it in key. So there was music is his first language, really. It's his primary language. He's spent more time, and he's probably spent more time on a stage in front of an audience than he has with any family member or any other person. So he was in familiar territory. He was in his most comfortable surroundings, which was fascinating to me. And what I discovered was is that the brain has obviously different areas that hold, whether it's, you know, motor skills or, you know, cognition for, you know, speaking, and then there's music is in a different part of the brain altogether. And so you discover how vastly complicated the brain is. And then when you realize that the research scientists have been since the Alzheimer's, all of us Alzheimer's, you know, over 110 years, been trying to find something to cure this thing. They haven't gotten close to curing it, but they are very on the verge of slowing it down. You know, it's an exciting time for people, not necessarily for Glenn, but what Glenn has done, he's created a conversation even in Washington, D.C. when we went there. A lot of these guys didn't have any idea what was going on, and Glenn brought forward the reality of just how expensive this is going to be to the world. I mean, most people are so involved with their own lives, unless they're personally affected by Alzheimer's, they don't want to know about other people's problems. They got their own, you know. But it's gonna break the national economy if we don't figure something out. By the year 2050, by the year 2025, it's going to exceed the national defense budget, the cost to the country. So Glenn did a huge service for all of us. He really did.
James Keach, director of the documentary Glenn Campbell, I'll Be Me. This is The String from WMOT Roots Radio in Murfreesboro in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm Craig Havockhurst, and I thought I'd round out this episode with a few minutes of Glenn Campbell himself from way back at the point when he'd recently become a major star. It's 1969, and he was interviewed by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. The audio is a bit noisy, but you can hear Glenn here talking about the changes in his life, especially as it relates to his hometown of Delight, Arkansas. Because now everybody knows his name and loves his music.
The pace really affects family life more than anything.
In what way?
Well, like when we went home for Easter, you can't sit around and talk to mom and dad and brothers and sisters. There's always somebody dropping by the house, you know. Like Easter Sunday, I think it's something like 127 people. Somebody kept count that just came by the house, you know. Well, it wasn't that way before. I could go home and visit, you know, maybe a couple of friends would come by to say, you know, or you go fishing, you got four or five boats following you around the lake, you know, if they know you're there.
Somebody makes it big, they'll always be sticking a rib in your side.
Right. The people is what the amazing, the difference they treat you. Like a lot of people in business, when they make it big, they say, oh boy, so-and-so's really changed. Well, it's not them. I know I haven't changed, I don't think. Like when you go back home, the people treat you so different. It really surprised me.
Can you still sit down and play with them and pick with them?
Oh, yeah, we have musicals, but there's a couple hundred more people now than there used to be when 15 or 20 of us would get together and play, you know.
For anybody who hasn't ever been down in that part of the country, music is a way of life.
Yeah, it is.
It's a big thing.
This is, like I know the Campbell clan, we used to sit around, that's all we do. We'd have a musical once a week, once a month, once every 6 months, just whenever we could, you know. But usually every night in our immediate family, we'd be sitting around the house playing and singing, you know. Because there ain't a lot to do back on the farm, you know.
What do you call that music back there?
Well, we'd play everything. Like I do on the show, we'd play... Mom and Dad usually do a lot of the old folk things, like the alimony thing they did on the show, or... Yeah. In the Pines, stuff that they knew when
Carter
they were...
Carter family type stuff?
Yeah, the Carter family type stuff. Oh, even farther back than that, really. Because Grandpa Campbell used to sit around and play things that, you know, I could sit listening for hours. And he'd go back, like, into the 1800s music. I like music. I don't put music in a bag. I don't categorize music. I judge music like I judge people, by their character, how they are, you know. I don't say, this is country, this is pop, or this is bluegrass. It is, in a sense, but there's good and there's bad in all music.
You're listening to Glenn Campbell, an archival tape from 1969. The interviewer asks him about how he became part of the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour which was a big part of his break as a performer.
Well, I know Tom, known Tommy and Dickie for quite some time from playing guitar on their albums and sessions. And Tommy, when Gentle on My Mind was a hit, and By the Time I Get to Phoenix was a hit, and I won the Grammys, and Tommy said, you know, I didn't even know you could sing. And he said, can you talk? And I said, well, not too plain, you know, it sounds pretty country sometimes. And he said, well, you know, let's do a summer show. So that's really how it all happened.
When you hit Los Angeles, can you sort of chronologically place where you ran across John Hartford?
I actually didn't run into John until after Gentle on My Mind was a hit. I knew of John's work, well, mind you, his banjo playing and his writing, but John is really one of the pioneers, I'd say, of busting country music out of its shell of, like you say, writing about a lost love or a dead horse or something, you know, and getting in more with the mind instead of, you know, you broke my heart,
that's
so
right.
I'm going to break
that's
your
right.
jaw routine,
that's
you know.
Right. That's right. And you seem to, when you pick with him, you seem to know.
Oh, I have a lot of admiration for Johnny. He's, to me, he's one of the finest banjo players around, one of the finest songwriters and singers.
Yeah. As if there's no cameras, there's no audience there. That's
right.
Exactly where it's at. Do you do that off cameras? Is that how it stemmed from? As a matter of fact, sitting around during those sessions?
Yeah, that's what it stemmed from. John and I would sit around at rehearsals and say, hey, do you know such and such? And we'd play. This is the way, like, the country or hillbilly musicians are.
It's beautiful.
Or Bob and Bill, my bass player and drummer, they'll sit around and join in at rehearsals. And we said, hey, let's try this on the show. And we get more mail about that section of the show than any other part.
Glen Campbell from 1969 on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And that's our show. The String is a production of Hyundai Media, Roots Radio, and host station WMOT in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Thanks to Andy Kern for audio editing, and to Carl Jackson and Ashley Campbell for facilitating elements of this show. The Glen Campbell interview is viewable on YouTube at the Glen Fan Archive called Diamonds in the Rough. Our theme music is by Brian Sutton. I'm Craig Havikhurst, and I hope you'll join me again for more conversations about culture, media, and American music on The String.